My guest today on the program is Steve Vick. Many of you may know Steve because he is the host of the Nonprofit Ally podcast, one of the top podcasts for the social sector. Steve has been a mentor to me in helping me get my podcast up and running, and Steve and I have collaborated on several podcasts together. Steve is the executive director of Noble Paws, which is a nonprofit that teaches people with disabilities how to run a team of sled dogs. He is based in Fairbanks, Alaska, and has a degree in multimedia development. He has a passion for content creation, capacity building, and program development. Besides being the creator of the Nonprofit Ally, he is an amazing expert on everything that is marketing and crowdfunding for the social sector. So I'm thrilled to have his 501c3 BS on the podcast today. Everything you ever wanted to know about marketing and crowdfunding. Welcome to 501c3 BS, deprogramming for organizational growth. I'm your host, Zoot Velasco.
We just need one big fundraiser.
Our clients are our donors.
Bigger is better.
Who cares what the mission statement is?
I work in nonprofits.
Bullshit! So, welcome to the podcast, Steve Vick.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to be here.
I can't tell you again, I say this every time I talk to you, but it's been such a great thing for you to kind of mentor me a little bit in this podcasting gig.
Oh, it's been fun. I've found that it's one of those things, like, everyone learns from everybody, and so I just want you to have a wealth of knowledge with your hands-on experience and the degree you have and all the, it's just been great. It's been a good partnership, I guess, in some sense.
Well, good. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to doing more with you in the future. But today, we're talking about your 501c3 BS, and your expertise and background is really in web-based marketing and communications and even crowdsourcing through the web. So I wanted to ask you, as the great podcast host of Nonprofit Ally, one of the top podcasts in our sector, and all the work that you're doing with Noble Paws up there in Alaska, do you want to tell them a little bit about what your organization Noble Paws is all about?
Oh, yeah. Well, Noble Paws inspired me to make Nonprofit Ally, because we started Noble Paws, which is a nonprofit, and it's a nonprofit where basically we teach people with disabilities how to run their own dog team. And so I have a team of sled dogs here and a bunch of equipment, and at-risk youth, people with disabilities, people with addictions can come here, and then they just learn all things dog sledding, and it's a weekly program that runs for 6 months. And it's been fairly successful. It's been met pretty warmly by the community. So, but by starting that nonprofit, that's what inspired me to start Nonprofit Ally, because it wasn't easy. Like, starting a nonprofit when you're kind of on your own and you don't want to pay thousands for a lawyer and buying books and searching the internet, I was everywhere looking for this info. And so I created Nonprofit Ally to streamline that process, which turned into a podcast and turned into this call eventually.
Well, cool. Yeah. I would love to see firsthand what you do, but there's probably no time in the near future. I'm going to Alaska, and I doubt if there's any sled dog things in California, so probably not going to happen. And the other thing is that on this show we try to avoid the N word being nonprofits, because as you know from our first podcast, we did a whole podcast about how it can be kind of a negative term for our industry. But since your whole podcast is called Nonprofit Ally, I'm going to give you a pass.
Nice. I appreciate that. Yeah. But I appreciate the change you're trying to make for the sector, because it's kind of a misnomer just by the name of it. And I think people from business sectors get confused by it, as well as people who run them themselves.
I interviewed a really wonderful lawyer named Mae Harris on our first episode for this season that's coming out. And I asked her what the most calls that she gets on anything related to the law and our sector. And she said the most calls she gets are people that have a profit at the end of the year, and they're wondering how they have to get rid of it because they're nonprofits.
Well, I hopefully you addressed that with your audience already.
No, we covered that. But okay, so let's get to your mythology, your 501c3 BS. So what things do you get in your realm of work that you would like to demystify today?
Yeah, since I kind of cover a lot of things between what I've done with Nonprofit Ally and starting my own, And I have an expertise, like you said, in web and marketing and online stuff like that. But I kind of have a mix for you. And one just starts with new nonprofits. So I have five of them here for you. But we'll start with this. Like a new nonprofit. I remember when I started my nonprofit, and I was just thinking, like, the myth would be, it's a great idea. Everyone's going to support me. And it may be a great idea, and maybe some of them are going to support you. But I have found, and I think many people find this, as soon as you get into the nonprofit sector, everyone thinks they have a great idea, and everyone thinks everyone's going to support them, and everyone's going for the same funding, and everyone is trying to find the donors. It actually turns into a lot of work. What we think is going to be easy, once I start this, boom, I got 10 friends who think it's a great idea. And they may end up not, or maybe they do, they give you $50, or they give you $100, but you have to keep reminding them, and you realize, like, wait a minute, this is fundraising, this is work, this means I need to have a database and I need to start communicating with them. So it just doesn't, you don't just turn it on and it happens. And I think a lot of people go into the idea with so much passion and energy for their idea, and they think, well, once it's there, it's just going to happen. It requires work. And I think the good thing about people who start nonprofits is that we're passionate, and so our passion drives us through the hard times and through the work. Like, it doesn't feel like work. But it does, it will at times feel like work. You're like, oh, geez, it's fundraising time, or I have to do this outreach again. So the idea that your nonprofit is a great idea and that's going to get instant support, I believe that's a bit of a myth.
Yeah, you know, we covered this on our first season. We did an episode about starting an organization and all the myths involved with that, with this really wonderful woman, Cynthia Friedman, who works for Community Partners. And they're a group that basically incubates new organizations. And I know that you cover new organizations every week on your podcast. Do you think, with all your experience with new organizations, do you feel like sometimes new organizations, their founders are kind of maybe on a little, sometimes are on a little bit of an ego trip where they're covering something that might not be new or may not be needed, but it's important to them and they want to start it, even though there might be an organization that already exists out there, but it's important to them to start it.
Right. Well, you point out something like the research you should do before starting your nonprofit is making sure that you're not doing a redundant service, or that someone might be doing something that's similar to yours, and maybe not in the way that you're envisioning it. And I would always suggest go to that organization then and find out if you can help them or be part of what they're doing. Because in some sense, if you create something that's already being done or something that's similar, you create confusion, and then you also create competition for limited resources. That's not always necessarily a good thing. So it may be the person's ego. It may be that their idea is better, or they just don't want to work for somebody. I know that my idea, when I researched my idea and I discovered no one was doing it, thank God, because if someone was doing it, I wanted to run it. That's my ego, right?
Yeah.
I want to run it because I have the better idea and I would do it better, and I don't want to work for somebody because I'm the founder. And that can be a problem for people.
I think that happens a lot.
Yeah, we actually had twice I've had this question come in, because on my podcast we have this Ask Tom. Tom's a lawyer. And we answer questions for nonprofits. And twice this has come up from two different people. They, as the founder, wanted to protect themselves in the bylaws from being removed by the board. And there's all sorts of red flags with that. And part of that's probably ego. Like, I don't want anyone to take over my idea. But the idea of a nonprofit is that it goes on in perpetuity. It should exist forever. It is a separate entity from you. It is a corporation, even though corporations are people. It's a corporation that is separate from the founder. It's separate from the board. And that corporation's health and long-term well-being is dependent on a strong board with good policies and bylaws, all this stuff in place, so that when you roll over your board or the founder moves on, that it keeps going. It shouldn't die with the founder leaving. And if you're going in there with the idea that you are the one who has the best idea, then how does that go on when you leave? Like, is this idea only for you, or are you actually there for, is it there to serve the people you're serving?
Yeah, don't you think a lot of people, they have an idea to start a restaurant, or they have an idea to start some for-profit business, and some people start an organization in the same way. They're like, oh, I have this great idea, and I'm going to drive it, and it's going to be my thing. And they don't realize that the whole purpose of a community organization is to do something that benefits the community, not necessarily you.
Right. And you can't do it alone. You really need people in the organization to help you. You need support staff. You're going to go to peers in your community and reach out to them. And can we collaborate? Can you send me some people who you think would qualify for my programs, things like that. So the idea from people I think approach is that I can have a nonprofit and get paid to do what I love to do. And the fact is, you're not going to get paid right away.
Right.
You do, it's not going to be, it may be in the long run, you creating yourself a job and something, but in the end, it's got to be set up for, like we said, in perpetuity of expansion, right? So it always moves on to the next board, the next director, the next person.
And if you're successful in that model, that's very kind of ego-driven, what ends up happening is founder syndrome, where you end up where you're doing it with very little help, and the people helping you are not A-type personalities, and you don't have anyone to carry on when you're ready to give it up, or you're bringing people in to take over, but you don't really want them to take over, and you're sabotaging them at the same time that you're bringing them in. So,
or you get pushed out by your board.
Or you get pushed out by your board, yeah.
Right. I did an interview with someone who actually had the effects of founder syndrome and was pushed out by her board. And it was a horrible, personal, emotional experience for her. And, you know, years later, she could look back on it and go, oh, I needed to step away. It was a good thing in the end. It was a good thing for the organization in the end. But there was a lot invested in her emotionally in it. So yeah, it's a tough thing.
Well, so now that we've identified the BS, let's go about fixing it. So I think when new organizations work best, it's when there's an organic need that comes out of the community that some people just say, look, I'm gonna be the one to address this need. And then they get a whole bunch of other people to help them. And that becomes an organization. Like, for example, when there's a historic home that's going to meet the wrecking ball and people say, look, we don't want this 1890s house in our community to get, you know, demolished. We're going to try to save it. And they work to save it and they succeed through an organic grassroots campaign. And then they say, well, now that we've saved it, we have to run it. So then they form a nonprofit organization to do that. And that's when things are really successful, when you can get a whole groundswell of support and then create a community organization out of it.
Yeah, I think part of it is that research again. You're going to start a new nonprofit. You have this idea. Go and research. Who's doing it? How are they doing it? How have they succeeded? Who in the community is helping them? Where are they getting their funding? What services are they providing? Who are they providing the services to? And where would you fit in among that? And then who's going to be able to help you with that? Like you said, it's a team effort, right? And that kind of research going into there gives you a good foundation. It's basically building a business plan for your nonprofit, which you should do because you need to know the services you're going to need, the support you're going to need, the equipment you may need, what the cost of it's going to be. Start looking for board members who would be interested and are going to be dedicated and have experience of some type that's going to be of value. Like that's a good way to approach it. And then when you start off, you have a team doing it. You really got to look at it like a team. When you're doing it. If you do it on your own, you're going to get stressed out. You're going to be frustrated. You're going to be fundraising in the middle of the night. And this is me talking from experience, right? All this kind of stuff. And you're like, oh, I need help. You know, no one loves me and all this kind of stuff. And so just grab the people there that are willing to help and use them. And let them, people aren't going to be invested unless they feel like they have some ownership in it. So give them a project. Let them own it. Don't micromanage it. And give these people some free rein to represent your passion, you know, and merge it with their passion. It really can't be done on its own, not successfully and not healthfully.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember after the L.A. riots in Los Angeles in 1992, and I was really involved in the area that the riots were in because I was doing work in the schools there at that time in that area. And after the riots happened, there was just this groundswell of people wanting to create things in what was then kind of a desert in terms of a lot of things. There were no grocery stores. There were no services of any kind for great swaths of Los Angeles that were kind of forgotten areas. And people came in and started all kinds of new organizations that did all kinds of things, and it really transformed Los Angeles. But it was through these grand swells of support of multiple people coming together and wanting to do things rather than just one person saying, hey, I have a great idea for myself.
Yeah, it's a community, yeah.
All right, so what's some other myths that you want to bust today?
I have four more here, but one of them is the idea for marketing, right? People think marketing is a four-letter word and that they're a nonprofit and they shouldn't be spending money on marketing and that they don't want to be salesy and they shouldn't have to pitch themselves, right? And so people avoid the whole marketing thing, thinking, again, going back to, it's such a great idea, it's going to sell itself type thing. It's not, right? And so what I tell, like the idea that marketing makes you salesy and marketing is a waste of money, or my supporters aren't going to fund marketing, you got to get around that, because how are people going to know what services you are doing if you're not doing some type of marketing? And what I try to tell people is, and what a lot of nonprofits do end up saying is, well, we don't do marketing, so you have a communications director. And if that makes you feel better, then you're the communications director, but your job is marketing. And marketing is, you may never realize you're marketing. When you put a PSA, you're marketing. When you do a poster in a local store, you're marketing. When you send thank yous out, you're marketing. This is all some type of communication outreach, and it's a form of marketing. Not necessarily the marketing that we think of with the guy at Late Night TV selling you kitchenware. But it is a marketing, it's a multifaceted marketing approach, because every time that you go publicly out into the community, whether it's through a TV sponsored ad or Facebook or whatever, you're representing your organization, you're marketing. And so you're marketing when you go to a Kiwanis Club meeting and you're the keynote speaker there because they want you to talk about your services. You're marketing at that point. So you're always in that role. And if you're the founder or the ED, anytime you shake someone's hand and they say, what do? You have a one-minute elevator speech to do right then and there on the spot, and you're marketing. And so it's kind of a hard concept for people to kind of understand that you're always always be marketing, I guess. but it's to me, it's an important aspect of it.
Well, you could say always be communicating. They're ABC.
See, I thought of that. But it's really important, and you have to have a good sense of who you serve, what you do, and why you do it, so you can communicate that quickly, right? That elevator pitch is really important. We got ours down to, we're a marketing school for people with disabilities. And then all of a sudden people go, well, how'd that work? And now you want them to follow up with a question, right? You don't want to say something, people, oh, that's nice, and then move on. But you should have a good one-minute elevator pitch that turns into the person that you just said it to wanting that no more. And that's part of marketing too.
I think you couldn't have said it better. I mean, and that's why I really wanted to have you on today, was specifically to address these marketing myths, because I make a career out of going into broken small organizations and fixing them. And in almost every organization that I've gone into that is in deep trouble, I'll say, who does your marketing? And they'll say, marketing? We don't have a marketing director. We don't have a communications director. You know, that's fancy stuff for when we have money. We don't have money yet, so we can't do any of that stuff. And I say to them, well, it's that stuff that's going to get you money. You know, fundraising doesn't happen in a vacuum. It has to happen as a result of marketing, because you have to market your programs to both the people who are using the programs, because a lot of times their programs are empty too. There's nobody using the services. So, you know, you have to market to the people who are using your programs, but you have to market to the people who are going to support those programs as well.
Yeah. And everything you're doing, it's like anytime you go out, you're marketing too. And whether you don't have a person in that role, then assume everyone's in that role. So your ED is marketing when they send out the newsletter. Your volunteers are marketing when they go up and they help, they bring a dog to a hospital, right? So part of that marketing, it's simple stuff, though. It doesn't have to be like marketing plans are always really good and you should have a well-rounded one. But here's some basic ones, right? Some really basic stuff that you can do when you start. One is, this is going to seem for some kind of silly, look at your email address. Don't have a Gmail account. Don't have a Hotmail account. If you have a website, yournonprofitwebsite.com, right? Mynonprofit.com, whatever. Like we have noblepaws.org, actually. Sorry, not .com, .org, your nonprofit. But anyways, so automatically get that email, steve@noblepaws.org, right? Or director@noblepaws.org. That makes you professional. It when people see it, it makes them remember your name. And so this goes right into the next part, which is now you have that email, create an email signature. I can't believe how many times that I get an email from someone. I'm like, oh, that's right. I need to call them. I go check their email and they don't have their phone number in their email signature.
Right.
Your email should have an automatic, my name, director of, email address, website. Like just put it in there and automate it and make sure your email address is not Gmail and make sure that your website is on there.
And phone number too, if you can, I think is good.
Exactly. Because, I go in there, I'm like, okay, well, he or she, you know me, but I don't know how, now I got to go to the website. Oh, they don't have a website. They have a Facebook page instead. So
yes, I see that a lot.
Another one for you. We'll talk about that in a minute. But get an email thing. Get a business card. They're, for $20, you go on to VistaPrint, something like that. Brand it. Have a little logo. These are all low-cost things, but it's just you're just building your brand, right? So one of the first things you do is get that brand going. Get a letterhead made up, make a little Word doc, put your logo on the top left, put your address next to it. It doesn't have to be super well-designed. Just make it and use it. So people, like, the more they see it, the more it gets instilled in their brain and they identify that brand. And make sure it looks like your website, too. Make sure you have a website.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about the Facebook page versus the website, because I see that a lot. I see that a lot.
I got a good real-world example for you. First of all, folks, the myth is I don't need a website because I have Facebook. And that one drives me nuts because I have a dog mushing thing, and I have kids that come here, and they're at-risk youth, and we've been training for the first race of the season in town here. There's something called Junior Dog Mushers. And so the Junior Dog Mushers, God, I hope you're not listening to this podcast because it really ticked me off. So anyways, but this isn't just them. This is what a lot of people do. But this is a real-life scenario. I have kids wanting to go to the races. The race got canceled because the temperature was too cold. It was like 20 below, and their cutoff is 15 below. So no race that weekend. So they rescheduled the race for the next week and put it on their Facebook page. I'm not on Facebook, kind of, right? And also Facebook is a feed. So if I don't happen to see that post when you put it on there, the next day I go on, I don't see it because it's buried in my post. I had kids come to my kennel the day of the race, and we didn't even know there was a race going on. And so we trained the dogs instead of going to a race because we weren't informed of the race. And that's because they didn't have a newsletter, they didn't have a website, and they didn't have a calendar, and they put it on Facebook. They got lost. And there's other reasons not to use Facebook. Like, that's a real – that one just – I'm like, ugh, why don't you have a mailing list? Like, that just seemed like – a no-brainer, right? And there's really no excuse to it because mailing lists are easy and they're affordable because they're free. It just takes a half hour to set up MailChimp, maybe pay a web developer $50 or $100 to connect it to your website, and you're good to go. Then you send that mailing list out. Folks, we changed the race date, or we rescheduled the race to this day. Everyone that's in your program is on the mailing list. They all know about it. Don't rely on Facebook for that. The other issues with Facebook is just that timeline is an issue because when you post stuff on Facebook, it gets lost in the timeline. And Facebook is always changing their algorithm. They just changed their algorithm about 3 weeks ago. They are no longer prioritizing pages and things like that. So I like 5 pages, let's say. And I go on Facebook. Let's say I'm a daily user of Facebook, and I always see these pages on there because I like them. Well, Facebook wants you to be more family and friend-oriented, so they are prioritizing your friends and family in your timeline. And they've deprioritized pages, groups, not so much, but still, they've prioritized the friends and family. So now those 5 Facebook pages that I like from the nonprofits or whatever, local ski clubs or whatever, are not being seen because they're less of a priority for Facebook to show them. And typically, most people don't go on Facebook and then go to your page to visit you. If they don't see it in their feed, then they're not going to see it. And so you got to watch out for that because that algorithm changes all the time. Facebook controls that. You also have to watch. Anyways, you might want to chime in here. I've got a whole list.
Well, I'll tell you what I hate about people that use Facebook as their website. So my wife and I, we take 10% of our income and we put it into a community foundation fund that we direct. And we're funders. We're minor funders, very small amount of money, but we give money out to organizations. And when I'm looking to give money to organizations, that sometimes I just give money to organizations that I've worked with and I know, and I like the CEO and I like where it's going. But sometimes I'm looking for new organizations to give money to. And if I hear of something that sounds interesting to me and I think, oh, they're a small organization that could be really going somewhere and I want to invest in them, and then I go to look them up and all I see is a Facebook page, I think, oh, they're not very well managed. If they don't have a website, then they're not really going anywhere. They're not very well managed.
And it's, excellent point. Excellent.
So I think a lot of funders do that. I think a lot of funders see something that's just a Facebook page, not a website, and they think, oh, this place hasn't even gotten it together enough to create a website, so they're not going to get it together enough to do anything with their mission.
I would almost say all funders do that. The first thing they're going to do is go to your website. They're going to check you out on the web because that's the easiest thing to do. They're sitting at their computer when they get your application. They're going to go check out your website. If there's not a website, then there's a strike against you right away. And your website, like, Facebook is, you need Facebook, folks. It's a good tool. It's great for social outreach and generating awareness and kind of, it's fun, right? People go there for fun. But your mission statement, your upcoming events, your newsletter sign up, your donation page, all of that is on your website. And your website is your platform. That's your launch pad. Your Facebook feeds that. You should be driving people from Facebook to your website. You drive people from YouTube to your website, from Instagram to your website, because you want them on your website, because this goes into the next, kind of into the next myth, and some said you want them on your website because that's where you convert them. You convert them to followers, volunteers, donors, supporters, right? So your website's a conversion machine in some sense, and it's also how you get your message out to everybody because you have total control of your website. You don't have control over Facebook. You don't have control over YouTube. You don't have control over the social media platforms. And so the next myth is, I don't need an email list, or actually a lot of people don't want an email list because they don't want to be spammy, right? That's great. People use it for spam. No doubt. We get spam all the time. But you need an email list. You need a form of communication so you can reach out to your volunteers, your supporters, your board members, your past donors, whoever, right? And that email list is gold because you want people to sign up for it. And people aren't going to just – you're not putting them on there like a spammer. You can't do that. There's laws about that. But you want them to sign up, want more information about the services we provide. Sign up here. Now you have someone that's interested in that. And it'll take, you know, some communication to convert them into maybe a person who uses your services or someone who donates. But trying to do it cold, like with a phone call out of the blue or a flyer sent in the mail, you're not nurturing that relationship. One of the best ways to nurture that relationship is through email. You send them an email on a regular basis with valid information that's pertinent to what their passion is or why they signed up, whether it's a volunteer opportunity or someone who's on the edge about using your services and you announce that you have a new program and you announce you have new equipment, or it's a board member just – well, board members are a little different communicating because they should be invested in what you're doing. But it's a good way to get those users involved, and having an email list is – it's one of the best ways to do it, and use it. You got to use that email list.
Absolutely, and the same is true even for in real life marketing. When you're talking about actual brochures that you have, you know, making sure that those brochures get out to people. The only bad brochure is the one that you print and never give out. So. I remember visiting some organizations, one organization in particular that I was doing some consulting for, and it was run by some women that were in their 70s, and they weren't really into online stuff yet, but they had a young intern who was helping them with that. But they had these really beautiful printed brochures, and I went to get one, and they said, oh, okay, we'll let you have one. And I'm like, what? And they said, well, we try not to give out too many because we only printed a certain amount and we don't want to have them all given out. And I'm like, that's what a brochure is for. Come on, dude. You're not going to ever get too far with your marketing if you're like hoarding the brochures.
Yeah. Yeah. They're operating in scarcity mode in some sense too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just that. Yeah. You just got to get out there. The myth being that emailing is spam or just that type of communication is spam, it's not. People want that information and they should have it in their hands, whether it's through a brochure or an email.
Yeah, but like you said, you don't want to cold solicit emails because there are laws against that. But you should definitely have a sign up sheet at every event that you have and try to get people to give you their emails. And when people email you, put them on a list.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And once you build that list, you got to use it. Like, don't just use it when you're asking for money, because people see through that right away.
And it doesn't cost money either. I mean, what people think, all of this stuff is expensive, having a website, having email. Having a website costs very, very little, and you can do emails for free till you get to a point where you're emailing so many people that you have to pay for it. And it runs organically then. Once you start to have to pay for it, it's a little bit, and then it becomes a little bit more. I mean, most of the email servers like Benchmark or what are some of the other ones? Constant Contact, MailChimp, most of those places will let you do it for free till you get to a certain point where they want to start charging you. But, you know, by then you should be making some money where you can afford to do that.
Yeah. And there's so much information on through podcasts and through the internet on how to, one, build your list, but two, use your list, right? So
yeah,
the idea being that I have someone who's interested in something that we're doing. And so I create a way for them to, here's one thing. Don't just put your email sign up in a little box in the corner and say, sign up for our newsletter. Create a landing page that gives them information about a particular, how to overcome some type of disability, how to overcome an addiction, or whatever your service is, right? Here's five tips that we suggest you use to overcome these things. To learn more, sign up here. We'll send you the free ebook or the free brochure. Now you have their email, and in return, you've given them something of value. And so and you're going to have a higher conversion rate. Sticking it on the right-hand sidebar, and a lot of people do that, and I've been guilty of this. You know, people might sign up for that, but you haven't really given them a reason. But you give them a landing page full of information that shows that you are an authority on the topic that you're discussing, and you're going to give them something in exchange, something of value. They'll give you that email, right? And that email is really important. And now you have someone who's interested in holistic ways of dealing with asthma or, you know, whatever it is, that topic. And now you know exactly what that person's interested in. They get put on that list, and now you have what's the target audience? I can't think of the right word right now, but on a list that's specified, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's free. MailChimp is free, and you just get integrated. So.
You know, that kind of leads into another couple of myths. One is something that you run into with organizations that are older, run by people who are older. You know, you have half of those organizations where the people, dispel the myth that because they're older, they can't be technically savvy. And they actually get into the internet and they learn and they do what you would do no matter what. You're trying to learn something new. You would get in, you'd learn it, you'd do well with it. But the other half of the organizations, they kind of throw their hands up and say, well, I'm not going to learn this stuff, and I don't have the money to get somebody to help me, and so I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to have my Facebook page because I figured that out on my phone, and that's it. And so, you know, what I always say to them is, you know, there are wonderful people in college who are looking for unpaid internships that they have to do to graduate. It's required for the graduation. Have you thought about partnering with a college and getting some people in to help you, and not just to do it for you, but to teach you how to do it so that you learn how to do it? Because I hate it when people who are older say, their phone breaks. My father-in-law does this all the time to me. His phone breaks and he says, here, fix it. And I'm like, let me show you how to fix it so you could do it yourself. No, I don't want to learn. You just fix it and I'll ask you the next time. It's like, sometimes people get to an age where they just don't want to learn anything else anymore. And that's just the wrong attitude.
Things change so fast that you have to be on top of it. And whether it's you specifically being on top of it or someone that's a volunteer or a board member or paid staff that's doing it, somebody has to be on top of it. If not, you're going to get lost. Nonprofits around here that still use listservs. And that just drives me like, listserv? Really? I mean, come on. So it can be frustrating.
For our younger listeners, what is a listserv?
Listserv was developed by universities, and basically it's kind of like a newsletter. You sign up for it, but it's kind of like a forum through email. And if you want to get a lot of email that's overwhelming and listen to people bicker about things, get on a listserv. You're not back and forth. Oh, well, I don't think that, and you're wrong, and like whatever. It's just a crazy conversation. And you're like, I don't care about this topic, but I'm on the listserv, so I'm getting all these emails. They're way outdated, but people still use them. They're still around.
All right, so what other myths you got for us, Steve?
So I got one for you that kind of it's an accumulation of all of these, right? And so here's the thing: we're gonna switch to fundraising. We're gonna go to crowdfunding, right?
Okay, great.
I'm gonna tell you right away: crowdfunding has nothing to do with fundraising. It has nothing to do with fundraising. Your successful crowdfunding campaign has everything to do with awareness and everything to do with marketing. So everything we just talked about, if you want to run a successful crowdfunding campaign, everything we just talked about, you have to have in place, or you're limiting your ability to succeed. And what I mean by that is, if I start a crowdfunding campaign and all I have is a Facebook page and I don't have a mailing list and I don't have a website, then who am I bringing to that crowdfunding campaign? Crowdfunding is an online platform where people donate money. That's great. But how am I bringing those people in there? Right?
Yeah.
Facebook posts? You're going to have this multifaceted plan in place, which means you already have. Well, not necessarily, because I did a crowdfunding campaign and I didn't have a mailing list. I had to create one, but I did have a website. But, you know, all the pieces that go into it, you need some of them in order to be successful. And so crowdfunding is an awareness campaign. It's not a fundraising campaign. It's an awareness campaign that's designed to inform, inspire, motivate, somehow emotionally connect with people, bring them to the landing page, and then from there you're looking to convert them. But that's still through stories, right, through emotional appeals, all the factors that go into converting someone. And then they become, you know, hopefully a donor. But the thing I see with crowdfunding, I'll give you the other myth on crowdfunding, is, and it's almost like what I said with a nonprofit. You start your nonprofit and everyone's going to support you. Well, the same thing is with crowdfunding. A lot of people go into there with the idea that, well, I just turn it on and I'll start making money. Well, it's not a form and grow. You don't set it and forget it. This is it's a campaign. It needs to be nurtured. It needs a plan, a strategic plan. It has a timeline, right? You have pre-prepared content and lots of content, and you need to bring all that awareness in through your multiple avenues of doing it, whether it's your mailing list or your Facebook page or a video on YouTube. We've talked about this in the past, I think. We've talked about crowdfunding. Snail mail works fine. Send out postcards with the little self-addressed envelope. All that works, but you have to bring people into the campaign. The good thing about crowdfunding is it's that platform. And like I said with your website's your platform, right? You bring all things go to your platform where you're trying to convert them into people on the mailing list or supporters or donors, but all things lead to there. Well, when you do a crowdfunding campaign, it's the same thing. All things lead to the platform. That platform is the crowdfunding campaign, right? So don't try to be dispersing donations throughout Facebook and anyway, you want to say something?
Yeah, so let's define crowdfunding for the audience first, because I think different people have different ideas of what crowdfunding means.
Yeah, you know, the definition changes a lot because when it first came out, it was this new thing, right? And Kickstarter was one of the new things, right? And a lot of people Kickstarter when they need crowdfunding. And basically, it's just an online donation platform. And the idea is that...
So you have Kickstarter, you have GoFundMe, you have... there's some new ones that have come out that have done very well.
CrowdRise, Razor. So these are all really good ones. My favorites are Fundly and CrowdRise. They're really designed for nonprofits. GoFundMe is actually specifically for business or solo people. They bought CrowdRise specifically to make a nonprofit platform. So CrowdRise is owned by GoFundMe, and CrowdRise is the nonprofit version of GoFundMe. It's the same company.
I didn't know that. I've used GoFundMe. I didn't know that that there was a nonprofit version.
GoFundMe too, and now CrowdRise. And then I interviewed the guy from CrowdRise on my podcast. I'm like, oh, you're GoFundMe? He's like, yeah, let me tell you the story.
Interesting.
Crowdfunding is basically peer-to-peer software, peer-to-peer fundraising done online. So the idea is I go out and my goal is to inspire other people to tell other people about my fundraiser and bring them to my donation page. So I may put a post on Facebook about the fundraiser with a story about one of the kids we serve, Dog Mushroom, right? He did his first race, and here's him with his hands up over the finish line, right? Great little story, and I put that on there, and someone's so inspired, they're like, hey, I'm going to share this with my friends, right? And then they're going to share this with their friends. And so all of a sudden, your one post goes to two people, which goes to four people, which goes to eight people, which goes to 16, which goes, right? It's kind of like the old, was it Pearl commercial or Breck commercial, and she told two friends, and she told two friends. Totally dating myself there. Sorry, that's back in the script.
I remember that commercial.
But that's, you know, crowdfunding is kind of that way of that model of getting the word out and then bringing those people into your platform. And that can be done through, you know, an email, a Facebook post, social media, letters, posters. It's all there.
So I want to disagree with you a little bit on that. It has nothing to do with fundraising. I mean, it does have to do with fundraising in terms of it's a way to get people who are not your traditional funders involved, usually younger people, involved in your organization if you do it correctly. But you're right that it's really more about brand awareness than fundraising. Although I would say that for me, and what I tell people when I talk about crowdfunding in workshops and things, because I mention it in fundraising workshops, is I tell people it's really not something you want to do every day. It's not something that can be your normal type of fundraising. Unless you are a millennial organization just geared towards millennials, then maybe, you know, you could figure out a way to do that. But for me, I've always found it to be best used in emergency situations or when you have some really hot new thing that really appeals to younger people. For example, when I was CEO of an organization and somebody, an arsonist, tried to burn down our theater, and they burned just basically the part of the theater that housed the piano. And so the piano burned up and it did $40,000 worth of damage, including we lost a historic piano that we had. And there's a photo of the fireman putting the piano out that ran in the newspaper. And we used that photo and did a crowdfunding campaign with it. And we made the $40,000 in 1 week because the photo image was so strong and visceral to see a piano on fire being put out by firemen that it gave you such a visceral reaction that people felt compelled to give. And so it was a very effective campaign. But I think if I tried to do something like that every week, the donor fatigue would happen very quickly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely crowdfunding is something you do once or twice a year for specific reasons. So taking that as an example, what you just said, going back to the idea that it's an awareness campaign, sure, you want to raise money, and that's the ultimate goal, is to raise the money that you need. But look at it as an awareness campaign, which I'm sure you guys did, because you're going to have this image, this piano, this cause, this reason that you're going to put out there. And people who support you are going to see that, and they're going to be like, wow, this is really, wow, it's an emotional picture, and that's a great story. I'm going to share this with my friend who didn't know you existed.
Exactly.
Right? And so this person, all of a sudden, it's an opportunity to get more people to follow you. And whether they donate to you or not this time around, they subscribe to your newsletter, right? You've captured their email. They've liked you on Facebook. They're kind of following you. They're in the perimeter. So you have all these perimeter people in there that you've gathered. When you do a crowdfunding campaign, maybe 10,000 people, let's say, see some type of marketing about it, whether it's through mail or a poster or a Facebook post or an email, right? So maybe those 10,000 people see it. And of them, maybe 2,000 come to the site and actually read about it and watch your video. And of that 2,000, maybe 1,000, that would be a 10% conversion rate, which would actually be pretty high, donate, right?
Yes.
And now you have these donors, but you have this kind of an onion layer of people who are there, who are in the peripheral, who are coming in, who might have signed up to your mailing list. Well, now you got until your next campaign, right, maybe 6 months or a year later, to generate a relationship with these people and bring them closer in on the onion. So the next time you have a crowdfunding campaign, one, you have a larger donor base because you've just done the crowdfunding campaign the year before and gotten people on there. But two, the people in the peripheral are now a little bit closer. So when that next opportunity comes up, they're like, yeah, you know what? These guys are pretty cool. I've been watching them. Great videos. Oh, that was really funny to see that. And boy, did you see what they did for that kid? Or whatever, right?
And that's the job of an organization, is to get people from the outside in the community closer and closer to the mission of the organization.
Right, and communicating with those people and bringing them in, spreading the awareness, which goes back to marketing, right?
Yep.
So in some way, it all ties in together. We turn this full circle, which is good.
Another great story that kind of illustrates exactly what you're saying is back in 2010, the middle of the recession, we had this huge funding cut from the city. They were going to cut 100% of our program money and just give us some maintenance money, and that's it. So it was about $60,000 or $80,000 that they were proposing cutting from our budget. And we made that a headline on a crowdfunding campaign, looking for members. We're looking for people to buy memberships, not to donate, but just to become members. And what happened is it got shared with all of the people. This is a historic organization that is in a historic building that gets used a lot for weddings, which is kind of a social enterprise that helps support the art center. And so everybody who had gotten married there started spreading this around. And then we got all of these brides who'd gotten married there kind of all of a sudden caring about the art center, which they really never attended events, never really seemed to care about too much. But when they saw that the funding was getting cut, then all of a sudden they became members and cared about it because, you know, they saw something important happening. And so that crowdfunding campaign did exactly what you said. It brought people who were just kind of on the periphery and brought them closer because they saw something happening.
Yeah, and you never know who's going to be on that, who's going to see it, right? Like, we ended up, when we did our first crowdfunding campaign for Noble Paws, I ended up getting we ended up getting a newspaper, because we sent out PSAs too, and that newspaper article got seen by our state senator in Washington, who ended up is on the front page of the lifestyle section or something like that, who ended up signing it and sending it back to us, wishing us best luck from Senator Biggish at that time, who was the senator. But yeah, like, you never know who's going to see it. And boy, if you get someone who has a lot of followers that likes it, you know.
Oh yeah, it gets out there.
I didn't realize your niece had cerebral palsy, and that's what we do, and now you liked it, and you're, you know, a local rock star. Like, whatever could happen. So
is there anything else you'd like to add or throw out, or a myth that hasn't been covered yet?
I think we covered the ones that I wanted to talk about. So it was kind of like nonprofit. We quick review that nonprofits don't just assume everyone's going to support you, that you do have to market, and if it makes you feel better, call yourself the communications director, that emailing is not spamming, and that you do need a website and Facebook is not a replacement, and that crowdfunding is more than just fundraising.
It's been a pleasure to be able to interview you for the show. I want to thank you for letting me rebroadcast several of your shows on my podcast, because I think they were relevant and interesting to my listeners, and for really helping me get started in the podcast game. And I'm looking forward to your brain. Is it, what is it? Brain trust? No. What is that?
You're talking about the mind. No, I cannot even make up me. Mastermind. We're talking about starting a mastermind for nonprofits.
So, do you want to? Well, first of all, tell our listeners a little bit about your podcast, and then some of the new things that you're working on.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So I have Nonprofit Ally Podcast, which is for, you know, nonprofits that are either emerging or maybe have been around for a while, but just need to want to take that next step, you know, to get a more secure future and become more sustainable. But yeah, if you go to nonprofitally.com, the podcast is there. And a lot of what we just talked about, I have some free resources on there. I actually have, for new nonprofits, I have a How to Start a Nonprofit course, which is free. I have a way, I completely teach you how to make your own website. That's a free course. And I also have, we talked about branding. I have a free How to Brand Your Nonprofit course. So all those things are on there. And then one more thing I have, we talked about crowdfunding. I have an ebook about crowdfunding, which you'll see right away. There's a little pop-up that will ask you to go download it. And so if you download the ebook, you'll also get 5 emails from me that will teach you 5 lessons on crowdfunding. It walks you through, each one has a video and a lesson within it. And so it'll walk you through the stages of being a successful crowdfunder. And the reason I did that is because one of the stats I learned when I did my first crowdfunding campaign was that, and this is still true today, and this my first crowdfunding campaign was like 5 years ago, 50% of all crowdfunding campaigns fail to reach their goal. And there's reasons why, and they're really easy to overcome. And so I go over those in that email course that includes a free ebook.
Awesome. Well, thank you for all that you do for our sector. And if anyone wants any information on Steve or the many products and services that he provides to our sector, you can go to nonprofitally.com. That's correct, yes?
Yep.
And if you want to know more about his organization of sled dogs for people with developmental disabilities, you can go to noblepaws.org. Is that correct?
Yep.
And thank you so much for being on the podcast. I feel a little bit like I'm in Super Friends now because, you know, like you're Superman, I'm Batman, and whenever you call us together, we can eradicate evil somewhere in the world.
There we go. You know, I think we're developing a bit of a good clan going on here. I really appreciate it. I'm glad that you've come into this and brought your podcast in. You've got a niche in there that you're really fulfilling that my podcast doesn't serve. And your approach is just kind of fun and off the wall in a positive way. And I really appreciate that. Like, somehow you get away with it. Like, other podcasts that I listen to that are nonprofit-based, very serious, and this is the director of this, and we're going to talk about this. And, like, it's a lot of big words. And, like, what did they say? And that sounds like it's overwhelming, right? You really bring it down to a level where it's just easy to digest and it makes sense. And I appreciate that. I don't think enough people do that.
Well, thanks, Steve. I look forward to any time you want to get together or do something else. And when this is all edited, I'll send you the edited version in case you want to simulcast it.
That sounds awesome. I will make sure either I simulcast it or I at least put the link out and make sure everyone gets a chance to listen to it.
Thank you so much, and you have a great day.
Awesome, man. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 501c3 BS, Deprogramming for Organizational Growth. I'm your host, Zu Velasco. 501c3 BS is sponsored by the Gianeschi Center for Nonprofit Research at California State University Fullerton and the Mahalo School of Business. Join us at the Summer School for Nonprofits for one amazing week every August. Gianeschi is spelled G-I-A-N-N-E-S-C-H-I. That's G-I-A-N-N-E-S-C-H-I, Gianeschi Center for Nonprofit Research at California State University Fullerton and the Mahalo School of Business. Check out my Twitter feed at 501c3BS, my webpage at zootvelasco.com, and my book, The First 100 Days, on Amazon. The music is provided to us from our good friends at the traditional Brazilian choro group, Grupo Falso Baiano, and Amy Molinelli. Find them at grupofalsobaiano.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day free from BS.